Welcome to the Rodcast. I'm your host, Dr. Rod.
So my guest today is a certified workforce mindfulness coordinator, well-being teacher, certified coach, and also certified Reiki master. She's the co-author of the book, Happiness of Coaching. She's the director of physician and patient engagement at Mass General Brigham at Harvard. It's my pleasure to introduce Carmen Alvarez. Carmen, welcome to the Rodcast.
Thank you so much, Rod, for having me. It is such a pleasure to join you. And I want to applaud you for the work that you're doing in bringing these themes to the masses. A lot of topics that are very important for us to discuss nowadays.
No, it's absolutely my pleasure. And it gives me a lot of fuzzy warmness and nostalgia because you work at Mass General where I spent some time, and Brigham's when I was at Harvard, and it was such an amazing time. And to hear that, you know, the work you're doing is, you know, so cutting edge and in the one of the, probably, you know, the one of the most important hospitals in the world is super exciting. So I'm super enthusiastic, you know, to get into the weeds and hear more about it. But before we do that, I'd be really interested to hear sort of what got you to, you know, where you are today in terms of your journey. You know, how did you end up here?
Yes, thank you. And I do have to say, warm and fuzzies all around, because I love seeing you wearing our sweatshirt, you know, the Harvard Medical School. And I love speaking and connecting with our alumni who are now all over the world doing incredible things just as yourself. So it's wonderful. So yeah, so I, you know, at the core, I am an administrator, a healthcare administrator. I have spent many years at the healthcare institutions here in Boston where we serve. And I've directed programs, I've created strategies to support workforce well-being, diversity, equity, and inclusion, and most recently, addressing burnout and well-being. And those topics, as we all know, have been front and center in our societies for some time now. And so I've been honored that I was in a position to address it from an institutional level, creating policies, strategies, and programs, as I said, to address it. But I also started my own journey in healing at the end of 2016, which is really, really what has transformed my life and my focus and has become my mission and purpose now, to be honest. And that is that at the end of 2016, my youngest brother passed away unexpectedly. And it was devastating to me. My brother was my hero in many ways. You know, he had dedicated his time to be a first responder. So he worked with the Boston Police Department as an EMT. Or an emergency medical technician. And he was first to respond to calamities, you know, to really hard situations in Boston. And he never feared to put himself on the line. And in fact, shortly before he passed away, he had given an award from the state for his bravery in saving someone who had jumped in front of the train lines, perhaps to take his own life. When the team arrived, he was caught underneath the train tracks, and my brother jumped in. My brother, by the way, who is 6'3", or he was 6'3", a large guy. Wow. Nobody knows how he was able to get underneath the tracks where he was. who created a tourniquet of some kind out of his own, I don't know, something that he was able to get, and was able to create a tourniquet around the arm that was cut to stop the bleeding. He did all this underneath the tracks. It's just incredible the things that he did to save lives every single day. And he also brought life into this world. You know, he was able to deliver 8 babies in all sorts of situations.
Wow.
Yeah. And
that's more than a lot of doctors.
Yes. And to do so, too, in all sorts of settings, you know, the kitchen floor, the bathtub, the elevator, you know, all the places in which you can see, you know, an urgent situation. But yeah, so also to say that he definitely is a hero, someone who put it all out there to serve others, and who unfortunately died at such a young age. And so it was devastating. He was also a very close friend, aside from my brother. And so that experience really created a space in my life for pause. In unintentional pause, right? I had to, I pretended that everything was okay at first. I didn't know what to do with the grief, because we are often not experts in grief, I have to say, especially in our societies where the norm is to, you know, move on quickly and get back to quote unquote normal is the expectation. And so that's what I did, because I didn't know what else to do. I went back to work 3 days later. And then about 3 months after, it was clear that I could not continue that way. Obviously, the grief had taken a toll. Depression had set in. Complicated grief had set in. And so I decided at that time to take the pause that I needed. And I took off. What I decided to do was to go on a trip, a solo trip. It was a trip that he and I, my brother and I, had discussed doing together to Machu Picchu in Peru. And wow. 2 weeks before he passed away, I said, why don't we go? Let's just take off. He was experiencing burnout, by the way, too, and post-traumatic stress disorder from his work that, as you can only imagine, it was so stressful. And so I had begged him to take some time off in December to go and do this. And he said, we'll do it right after the holidays, sis. We'll go right after the holidays. And then in December, he passed away. So needless to say that going on this journey on my own in his honor was very significant in a pivotal point in my healing journey. So during that month that I was away traveling, I encountered a lot of medical moments, but also there were a lot of endless nights where it was just crying, right? And everything that comes along with deep, deep healing. And this is the thing, is that healing, as I like to always say to people that I work with, healing requires feeling. We are encouraged in our society to not feel. I mean, everything around us is designed to keep us from going within. You know, everything is designed to distract us so much. TV, even the news, social media. I mean, I don't have to tell you this. You see people walking around, even crossing the street, and they're still looking at their phones. You know, we are all doing it. So it's this constant distraction. And what it's doing is that it's keeping us from going within, from just putting that aside to feel our emotions, to deal with the things that required healing. And so the pause in this journey provided that space for the deep healing that I needed. And what emerged from that experience was, what's next? You know, what do I want to do with this experience? I can have it define me in several different ways. I could just, you know, end this trip and just say, okay, I'm all better now. Let's move on. Or I can decide that this transformative experience will not be for naught. It will not be a loss, that I will use this to help others. And so that's what I decided. I decided that this happened for a reason and that I do want to help other people so that they don't have to go through this pain. It was really one of the most painful things I've ever had to do, is to find a way to move on after this and to find a new identity. Because what happens with grief is that, and people don't realize this, but it just really messes with you, because you lose a loved one and then you have to figure out who you are going to be afterwards. And the truth is that you are not ever going to be the same, because you are not the same person afterwards, after having lost, you know, your brother, your mother, your father, your partner. You'll never be the same person again. You are now transformed. That's a fact. So the question is, what do you do with that? Who do you choose to do? I realized that it was a choice. It could be an intentional choice. And I chose that who I would be someone who, driven by purpose, would help other people. And so I decided that the journey, the pain, that all of that would be a catalyst for my transformation. And that's what brought me to become a mindfulness coach. So I got certified as a mindfulness coach first. And my intention was to help people navigate grief. It always has been my intention as part of what I do. But once I was there and I was studying mindfulness, I also I wanted to go deeper. I wanted to figure out a way to help people in healthcare, because I'm in the healthcare field, right? I work at hospitals every day. And so the idea of doing something that will bring me closer to patients emerged, was started to grow in my heart. Because he worked, and you know, my brother, this is all, everything that I do, it's because in for him, right? And for this memory. And so he got to save lives directly working with people day to day. And that's when the idea emerged of finding something that would bring me closer to patients to help them. And that's when I decided to pursue my certification as a Reiki therapist. So now, and that's what I do. I provide it to patients directly at the bedside at the hospitals. And maybe I can pause here and to introduce Reiki and what it is a little bit for those listening who are not familiar with what it is.
Yeah, so, I just wanted to say two things. Sorry to interrupt. The first one was that probably some of my fondest memories were working with the emergency response team at Harvard, and it was truly amazing time where, as part of my, you know, like so I worked in the emergency room at Brigham's, and you had to sort of cut your teeth and get familiar with it. They'd put you in with two EMTs, and then you'd drive around the city. And it was great because I got to see the city. I didn't know Boston, you know, I just arrived, and I had to go everywhere from South Boston. And I'd go into, I remember going into apartment blocks where there was, you know, some really hairy and scary stuff. The things you would expect to find, like heart attacks and things like that. But it was such an amazing learning experience, and one where the guys that had been doing it for so long taught me so much that of stuff that you don't learn like in medical books, because they were the front lines of the first ones responding to people. So they really knew how to talk to people, and they didn't see them in a emergency room, or in a hospital bed, which kind of changes the entire dynamic of a person-to-person relationship. They saw him in their house or in a supermarket, and that makes the whole dynamic like more real. So I learned a lot from them. So I just wanted to highlight that and give a shout out to all those folks doing that. And then secondly, I just really want to emphasize that while these concepts of like mindfulness and Reiki are maybe relatively, you know, new in the Western world, and a lot of people might not be familiar with them, I do want to point out that where you work, like Mass General, for those that aren't doctors, is probably the most important hospital in the world. And there's a publication, a journal that's called the New England Journal of Medicine, and it publishes, it's probably the most important clinical journal that exists in the world. And what patients are prescribed in Africa and Europe and all that science is based on what happens at Mass General. So the fact that you're doing something, you know, so kind of non-Western in the best hospital in the world is super, super interesting. I mean, how have you seen that I guess non-Western approach has been embraced by, you know, those folks working at Mass General and Harvard?
Thank you. First of all, thank you for saying those words about the EMT staff. And you're absolutely right. That's what makes them so unique is their heart that they bring to this work. Reiki itself as one of the modalities that is considered integrative medicine is similar to acupuncture, just to give you a background on what that is, in that it works in the nervous system. It can help the patients relax. It helps with anxiety and depression. So it works at the emotional level. It works at the mind level. It helps us help the patient come into contact with the mind-body connection. And just to ease healing, to allow the body to relax so that the body can heal faster, which is what the body is designed to do. Our body is designed to heal, really, in the ideal situation. It will use everything in its environment and in its power to get you to feel better. That's what it does. And so providing this tool through Reiki to allow the patient to get better sleep, to deal with nausea, to deal with anxiety and depression, and also helping with pain. You know, a lot of patients experience ease of the pain in the situation, what they're feeling through this therapy. Everything conduces for better and faster healing. It is a modality that we're seeing more and more used around the country in hospitals, specifically for cancer care. So you typically see it as a complement to oncology because of everything that I mentioned, right? It is demonstrated in some studies that perhaps we can link below afterwards, that the patient outcomes, you have better patient outcomes in oncology or surgery recovery and others when they are treated with Reiki throughout. And it's not just the patient feeling better, but you could see it in demonstrated outcomes, as I mentioned. And so it's becoming more and more usual than not, but you do have a good point in that Mass General, for example, is number one in research in the world. And of course, we're very, very academic and investigation focused and less on these modalities. So I started providing the Reiki therapy through the Brigham and Women's Hospital because they already did have it built in at the Brigham. And what's interesting at the Brigham and Women's Hospital is that it is location-wise a lot closer to other centers in the Boston region that do cancer care as well. And so perhaps thus it makes sense that it would start there. But we have recently started to offer this at the Mass General Hospital as well. I am finding that as the years progress, as the clinical team sees the effect on the patients, and as the patients request it themselves too, because the patients are starting to request it themselves. Wow. They're getting educated. I mean, you probably have seen there is this massive shift in the collective consciousness, I guess you could say, in this direction towards something bigger, you know, connecting to, you know, meditation. And that is becoming a lot more of in the vocabulary of the general population. So there's a greater understanding of connecting to oneself and to something greater via these practices. And so patients know about it and they request it. And our care teams are starting to also learn a little bit more about it, and they see the effect of it themselves. In fact, I've myself with other colleagues have organized Reiki for the staff. So we have days where the staff, the nurses, and anyone who works in the institution can come and receive, you know, 15 minutes of a session where they can relax and experience this healing. It's very gentle healing energy, and they love it. So once they experience it themselves, they want it for their patients as well. So typically they'll put in a call and they'll say, we have a patient that is experiencing a lot of anxiety, doesn't feel well, cannot sleep, or is dealing with a lot of pain, and they call in for Reiki. And I just love that it's happening organically. It's happening because the patients know and understand it and are requesting it. And then also the care team is starting to recognize the effectiveness, whether because they see it, the effect on the patient outcomes, or because they have experienced the therapy themselves and are now wanting it for their patients. So I think that we are well positioned to seeing more and more of this in the next few years.
That's super, a super interesting approach. It reminds me of what pharmaceutical companies do. So when they have a new drug they're pushing out, they have two ways of going to market. So one is they meet with the doctors, the clinicians, and they give them free medication. You know, they used to give them free trips, but that's illegal now in most countries, and freebies and stuff. But they are allowed to give like free samples in most countries. So they say, okay, I'm going to leave you these, you know, 20 free samples. And here's like a pamphlet about everything about it and all it does and why it's great and it's better than everything you're currently using. And the doctors will then say, well, I don't want to throw it away, so I'll just give it to maybe one or two patients that maybe can't afford, you know, to buy medication, or what I've been giving them hasn't really worked. And obviously to prescribe, you have to be really comfortable as a doctor to know what you're prescribing. So you need to know all the side effects, all the adverse, you know, reactions and contraindications and everything. So you'll become an expert before you dish it out to your patients. And so once you're comfortable with dispensing it, like then it'll be much easier to then the next patient comes. You already are up to date on all the contraindications, you know everything about the medicine. Now, the second avenue to market is when pharmaceutical companies target patients rather than doctors. And so it's the patient that comes to the doctor and says, hey, I read about this medication, or my aunt is taking this. I was wondering if I can take it. And, you know, that's what we're seeing with like Ozempic and Wegovy, where it's such a mass media like phenomenon that they're going to doctors, and the doctor doesn't want to say, well, I don't know anything about it, so I'm not going to prescribe it. So they have to read, you know, about it. They become very familiar with it in case a patient asks. So what you're describing, I think, is brilliant, because you're giving, you know, it to the physicians, where then they become familiar with it. Familiar enough where they can prescribe it and give it to their patients, but also creating that demand from the patients themselves, which is great.
It's happening organically. Again, you know, because we nowadays we see there is an attention put on modalities such as meditation and breath work, by the way, too, as well, which, you know, I utilize. And we're seeing more studies, you know. There are some studies. There was actually, for example, there was a systematic review published in the JAMA, Internal Medicine, which is another journal, important journal called in academic medicine, that highlights how mindfulness meditation is effective in reducing symptoms of anxiety, depression, in pain in clinical populations. In another study that was published in the American Journal of Medicine shows that breathwork techniques can improve lung capacity and therefore reduce hypertension. So we see that meditation and breathwork help patients manage chronic conditions by reducing the physiological impacts of stress, such as inflammation, cortisol levels. And these practices contribute to improved immune function, reduce pain perception, and then even better recovery times after surgery. One of my patients, I'll never forget this, while I was working as a Reiki provider at the Brigham, I came in to see her. She had called in for a session, and the nurse put in the order, so I came in, and she said to me, she was someone who was receiving frequent treatment, so she was often in the hospital about once a month or so. But she said, I know now to call for you guys as soon as I come in, because I have noticed that when I receive Reiki therapy, when I'm here, I go home sooner and I feel better and I recover from the therapy, the treatment that I'm receiving, better and faster when I'm receiving Reiki than when I'm not. And this is the patient saying, I've experienced this, I know this. And so this, I'm doing this for myself based on my own experience. So that tells you everything, right?
Wow. That's super, super powerful. Yeah. Coming from the patient. I do think that we're getting better in medicine at admitting that there's a lot of stuff we don't understand and don't know, and there's a possibility that there are alternatives to traditional, you know, Western medicine. So it's great to hear that that's being incorporated. Are you working with the Dana-Farber Institute? Because I know it's right across the street from Brigham, and they do a lot of like super interesting oncology therapy. Is that something that they're doing? I can't remember.
So I am not working with Dana-Farber, but you're right in that it is geographically close by in the Boston area as a cancer center. I do know that they offer Reiki there as well. Is also offered at the Boston Children's Hospital, for example, too, as well. Absolutely. So, you know, and just to echo what you were saying, the role of energy medicine or these modalities in healthcare is it's gained recognition in clinical settings in the last few years here. So the Reiki is often considered a complementary practice. It has been integrated into many hospitals to help patients manage pain, anxiety, and the emotional toll of illness. And so you'll see it in most cancer centers, you know, across the country, actually. So, and I, just to say that this isn't just, you know, it's beginning to be published in different journals. So there's a study published in the Journal of Alternative and Complementary Medicine that showed that Reiki significantly reduced pain and anxiety in patients undergoing cancer treatment. So other research published in the Journal of Evidence-Based Complementary and Alternative Medicine also supports the efficacy of Reiki in reducing fatigue and improving overall well-being in cancer patients. So you start to see that there is more and more evidence to support it, so that it's not only the experience of the patient, but we are seeing more studies. And I am encouraged by this, and feel excited and I look forward to participating in and having more and more studies. Because as you know, in our world, in healthcare, it hasn't happened. It has not been published, if it's not evidence-based and peer-reviewed. So I am hoping that we'll have the opportunity to have more published work in this area.
No, absolutely agree. I don't think I've met anyone in the UK that is a clinician that has come across it, but I do know that they are looking at more Eastern and non-traditional types of treatment and therapy, just because the NHS is so overwhelmed that it can't cope with the backlog and the caseload. For instance, for mental health, one of the things, there's too many people that are requesting services and the backlog is like 6-8 months. So they've even gone as far as like partnering with mindfulness, digital apps, and you know, anybody that they can get some help from. But I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, they start to look into Reiki and acupuncture in the near future.
No, absolutely. And actually in the UK, I have many colleagues in the mental health and well-being area, and there is a massive well-being movement that's starting from the UK that is inspiring many of us around the world. I am part of a community that's called WAHASU, or the World Happiness Summit. And last year, or this year in March, it happened in the UK. So we had the opportunity to hear from many colleagues there who are doing research in this, demonstrating the effects of modalities such as meditation and breath work in all aspects, to bringing into every area. And so, you know, speaking of meditation, I have to say, meditation impact on brain function has also been explored extensively, as you can imagine, because meditation, you know, we're all more familiar with meditation, more familiar. So there is research into the neuroplasticity, and that this is the brain's ability to reorganize itself, that shows that meditation strengthens the areas of the brain associated with emotional regulation, attention, and compassion. And that is both compassion towards others and compassion towards yourself as well. So there was a landmark study published in Psychiatry Research in neuroimaging found that long-term meditation practice leads to increased gray matter density. So can you imagine that, right? This is amazing. So this is the area of the brain that is associated with learning and memory. And other areas of the brain related to self-awareness, compassion, introspection. So these changes are associated with improved emotional well-being, reduced anxiety, and enhanced coping skills. So as you can see, it's all interconnected, really. And so when we speak about the mind-body connection, it's science. It's not only. Well-being, emotional well-being, it really truly is all interwoven, one in the other.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first class I ever took on epidemiology in med school. We had our first assignment was we had to download and read an RCT, a randomized controlled trial, and then explain it back to the class. I remember thinking, I'm going to pick the most obscure thing I can find, like just for fun, and to make it interesting. And I came across an RCT where they looked at meditation and something that was like left nostril breathing during meditation and its impact on cognitive process. And I mean, it was so long ago, I can't remember how they measured it, but it was all this. And so, as you say, I mean, the evidence is overwhelming to support, you know, that this is something that truly works, and that it's worked for many years now. And I mean, no pun intended, it's, you know, it's a no-brainer. And I'm not sure why it's not something, you know, we're teaching at a younger age in schools and the rest, you know?
Oh my gosh, I am so with you on this. And so thankfully, I do have to say, we are starting to see more of this working itself into the education system. So there are many schools and who are now incorporating it into the day-to-day. It could be something as practical as having the children do a round of gratitude. You know, let's take 5 minutes in the morning and say what we're grateful for. Or, you know, a lot of them focus on smiling or joy. Joy is so important. You know, it has become something that is like a nice to have, when in fact it should be. Joy should be part of our lives. It gives us energy and reason for being. And so I have seen, and there is a big effort from many fronts to bring this into the school system. So, for example, the U.S. General, Surgeon General, he has created a well-being framework that he is hoping to implement in schools that address the well-being of our children. And specifically, he is concerned about the use of digital devices, as you can see, you know, and the games and everything else, and what is causing in the development of the brains of these young children. So there is a whole framework that he has created, which we can link below so that people can look it up afterwards. And so there is that movement. So I'm happy that you brought it up. And then to touch on what you said earlier about breathing and breath work, I have to say that breath work is another powerful tool for activating the parasympathetic nervous system, which helps the body rest and repair itself. Which when I go in to see a patient, it's part of the Reiki practice, is that I breathe with them, right? So we do a breath work practice together, and it automatically begins to put the body into that state of rest and repair. So studies have demonstrated that controlled breathing techniques, such as those used in pranayama or, you know, the yoga practices and other breath work practices, can reduce blood pressure, improve heart rate, and lower cortisol levels, which, as you know, is huge, right? So incorporating breath work into patient care, particularly in high stress settings such as surgery prep or chronic illness management, can help patients manage anxiety, improve their physiological resilience to stress. And so, you know, in my own experience as a well-being coach and Reiki practitioner, I have seen numerous cases where these practices have had profound impact on patient outcomes. For example, as we said before, patients dealing with chronic pain have reported reduced pain levels and an enhanced sense of calm after integrating Reiki into their treatment plans. So similarly, those undergoing chemotherapy often find meditation and breath work beneficial for managing both the physical and the emotional challenges of their treatment.
Breathing is such a superpower that we're not really taught much about in medicine. I mean, I'm still learning how to do it. We did this cycle. I don't know if I can't remember if I told you about it, but we did this cycle 2 weeks ago for work, where every year, like, it's like 20, 30 of us from the company, and then some of who have left, like, join, and we cycle for 3 days. And this year was the hardest ever, and it was in Mallorca, and it was like 2,000, you know, meter climbs and whatnot. It was just nuts. And one of the thing that, there's two things that got me through it, because once you're in the middle of a mountain, like, there's no going back, because no one's going to pick you up. There's no magic helicopter that's going to take you. You know, there's no way rather than to just get on with the cycle. And so there's two things that got me through it. One was music, like cycling to like the beat, and, you know, pedaling. But I think more importantly, the breathing part. And it was thanks to the fact that I'd watched the video like 2 days before on exactly what you're talking about, the activation of the parasympathetic system. And cyclists have this thing where if you're mentally about to like hit the wall, or I think in the US they call it like blonking or something, when runners are like, they go into like kind of panic mode and their body just can't, it's more of a mind thing. And so your body goes into sympathetic overdrive and you start doing really shallow, fast breathing associated with sympathetic like surge. And what you need to do, yeah, exactly. What you need to do is like reactivate the parasympathetic system. So your heart rate lowers and then you can pump blood more effectively and efficiently to the muscles. And then you can actually get over, you know, the hill. And that's you achieve that by doing certain type of breathing, which is, you know, low, shallow and rhythmic and the rest. So it's such a superpower.
No, it is. It's connected with, it's directly connected with our nervous system. And our nervous system, by the way, has been with us from the beginning, right? But I want to say is what kept us safe over the years. So if you think going back many, many years ago when we had to, you know, be out there in the dark and take care of ourselves, and we never knew when a lion was looking for us to come and eat us, you know, that's what kept you safe, is what tells your system is to be in high alert, you know. What it creates, though, however, is that in those intense moments when you are worried, your fear and your nervous system is activated in that way, is meant to keep you alive. So it's a survival response. And so what happens is that all of your energy and your blood and everything goes towards keeping you safe. So if it's running, let's run. Or if it's, so that even today, however, unfortunately, is activated when you, yourself, someone, whomever, you, there is a perception of fear. And perception of fear is very much individual because it depends on what your brain identifies as something that is an unsafe situation for you. So as you can imagine, that means very different things for many different people, right? And so what happens is, in a stressful situation, if you've had a traumatic experience in the past, your nervous system, when it's put in something similar, even if it's not danger, but if it kind of seems like it's going to be a similar situation, it automatically begins that whole process. And so you do find it hard to breathe and et cetera. And you lose energy. Again, all your blood, everything goes towards, let's get you to a safe environment. And so the opposite is also true. So when we use breath work to change those signals, what we're doing is, by extending the length of the breath, you are sending the signal to the brain that everything is okay. Why? Because your brain says, oh, she's taking really deep breaths. That means that she must be relaxed. That means that everything must be okay. And so everything else, and your hormones, your cortisol, everything else goes, oh, no, no, false alarm. All is well. She's okay. She's breathing really deeply. This is a relaxation response. And so she's okay. And so the brain will automatically do this, send those signals to your body. So understanding this, we can intentionally manage the way we breathe to send those signals to the brain, therefore controlling the stress response in the body. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it does. And it's incredible how such a simple thing can have such a powerful effect on so many different metabolic and hormonal and physiological processes. I do wanna touch and talk a little bit about your book, and the title is super interesting. So Happiness by Choice. It reminds me of something that I've heard a few times in like the Buddhist world, where we are the architects of our emotions and how we perceive the world, and it's not what others do to us, but it's how we react to what others due to us. So I was wondering if you could maybe give us a little bit of insight into in terms of what you cover in the book and your chapter.
Yeah, thank you, Rod. the book is a collaboration amongst a few of my colleagues who are experts in the field of happiness and well-being and who are well-being coaches. And I was honored to be part of the project. My chapter in it is called Happiness by Choice. And it's inspired by my own healing journey of managing grief, navigating grief. And as I said earlier, choosing how that journey was going to transform me and what I would do with that experience. And so I do believe that we all have a choice in how we navigate experiences. Now, that is not to say that how you're navigating grief, it's wrong. There is no wrong way. We are human and we all manage grief in different ways. And that's why I've dedicated myself to help people navigate through this. I think that it has everything to do with self-compassion. There was so much of my journey that had to do with acceptance, right? When you're navigating grief, obviously acceptance is huge. It's easier said than done. And let me tell you, it's not something that you do and it's done and done. It's something that will be with you throughout your life. You'll have multiple opportunities to revisit when you're someone who has been through grief. It comes back over and over again. It gives you opportunities to evolve and expand and go deeper and deeper because you always have opportunities to go into self-compassion. So what I'd like to say is that it has everything to do with compassion towards yourself throughout the process. When I discuss the opportunity that you can allow it to transform you, and it's true for me, at least I wanted it to be part of my purpose moving forward, because for me, it has everything to do with service to others. I wanted it to be the purpose and outcome. And so for me, that was the choice. For all of us, when we're navigating difficult experiences and traumatic experiences, we have the choice of how we want that experience to affect us and how we respond to it, as you said, and what we do with that experience. And by the way, I wanted to pause here and say that in my own experience, I've discussed grief of losing someone, but there are many, many ways in which we grieve every single day. You know, losing a partner or a loved one is one, but also when you change jobs, losing your job, a divorce is immense grief. Separation, right? Separation is immense grief. There are many different ways in which even moving to a different country, there's a grief process, and changing jobs is a grief process. And so we all have opportunities to learn more about how our brain and our heart reacts to the grief process and how we have the opportunity to choose to lean into it and feel and go through the emotional process of healing so that it can transform us. And that is the choice. The choice is to feel and heal and then use it to service to others. And the outcome is joy, because joy naturally comes of the process of service to others or the process of self-compassion. It comes when you lean into being nicer towards yourself. It comes from leaning into curiosity, being curious about what else can I do with this experience or how may I manage this experience differently. It comes from being creative. Creativity is a great tool for healing as well. So in the book, I speak about, allowing all your creativity to be a great source of joy in the healing process. And yeah, so those are the points that I touch on, is self-compassion, stay curious, lean towards a feeling and versus closing your heart and a welcome joy via creativity and doing things that you love.
And yeah, a lot's published on that too, actually, on like, sense of purpose and positive psychology on the importance of doing what you love and how that leads to going into flow and then all the physiological responses to when somebody's in flow. Where can people find you if they want to hear more about the book or about some of the, stuff you've talked about and some of the stuff you might offer?
Sure. They can find me on LinkedIn. I publish a lot of this on LinkedIn. More on the organizational well-being piece. And I talk about the importance of addressing well-being practices for workforce well-being and workforce, just overall effectiveness on LinkedIn. And also I will link all of this below my website. I do have a newsletter blog where people can sign in, and I often talk and where I discuss all of these well-being in many dimensions, including what we discussed today. I do welcome the opportunity to work with people one-on-one. So I do one-on-one coaching. And I do organizational consulting as well in this, where I help organizations make the business case for well-being into their own organizational strategies. And so happy to discuss this with any leaders out there who would like to include well-being as part of their workforce development efforts. And obviously, there's also the Reiki, and I do retreats where I teach meditation and breath work and webinars. Webinars is a great way to bring this into your whether it is your staff, anywhere that you work. You can bring a quick little session where we discuss well-being, meditation, and breath work, and it can be incredibly effective for teams. All of these things will be linked below, and you just mentioned the podcast or mentioned community, and I'll be happy to make a special offer to everyone listening.
Perfect. Yeah, we'll be sure to put that in the link. So last question from my side. I know you probably have a busy day still ahead of you, but you mentioned so many great, techniques and things you've learned over the years in terms of, practically how to improve your well-being. What would you say maybe in the last 12 months is something you've maybe recently come across that's really been a game changer in your own sort of mental health and well-being that you could share with others?
I would say staying open, really staying open to the experiences and navigating with grace. Emotions, navigating your emotions with grace has everything to do with being open, being curious, and allowing these experiences to be a transformative experience for you. I think that oftentimes we keep ourselves from making changes out of fear and because we're so comfortable with what is familiar. So I say that I would encourage everyone to be open to feel through your experiences and stay curious and lean in and expect to find something positive out of the experience. That's what I say is most helpful.
It reminds me of something I heard not too long ago. I think Quincy Jones, the music producer, said it. He said, always make decisions based out of love and never make decisions based out of fear.
I cannot agree more with what he said. We could have a whole other podcast on fear and how it tricks the mind. into making us do things that are not really connected to our purpose, because fear is connected to the ego mind, and the ego mind is all about limitations, and it's often wrong. It's a delusion. So we could have a whole other discussion about that, but I love the quote and the fact that, yes, it's lean into the heart, keep an open heart, and when in doubt, lean into love.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Carmen. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Rod. It's also great to speak with you. And I love that we connected on your experiences as a young physician, going around taking care of patients with the EMT and in the emergency room. And again, I applaud you for bringing these topics to light that are so necessary and so needed. And you're doing such an amazing job. So thank you.
Thanks, Carmen.
Hey, thanks for listening, folks. If you enjoyed that, please hit subscribe, like, and share. See you next time.